Welcome to FMI's Built-In Podcast. I'm Scott Winstead, FMI Consulting President. I'm really excited to share my conversation with Scott Peterson, CEO of Interstates, with you today. Scott joined the company in 1995 and has held a number of key leadership roles within the firm, including CFO, President, and now CEO, a post he's held since 2014. He brings decades of financial and operational leadership to the role and is widely respected for his commitment to developing servant leaders, building strong teams, and casting a clear, values-driven vision for the future. During his tenure as CEO, Interstates has grown from $100 million to over $500 million in revenue and has become a go-to partner across critical sectors like data centers, food and beverage, energy and chemical, consumer packaged goods, water and wastewater, and value-added agriculture. What will become readily apparent as you listen to the episode is that Interstates is far more than your typical electrical contracting firm. In addition to electrical engineering and construction, they've built deep capabilities in industrial automation, analytics, and operational technology, enabling them to tackle complex, high-stakes industrial challenges. They've also created an award-winning, values-driven culture and are at the forefront of advanced prefabrication, shifting critical work offsite to deliver greater safety, speed, and quality. A voracious reader, Scott brings a powerful combination of business acumen, clarity, and humility to the role, and I'm excited to share this conversation with you. Well, welcome to the show, Scott. Thanks so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'd love to start out with just a bit of a from-to story, if we could, just to anchor the audience. It'd be great if you could share where Interstates has grown and evolved significantly over the last few decades. Kind of how would you describe the then versus now story?
Yeah, it's been a really fun journey and one that we probably couldn't write in the beginning if we sat down way back when. When I started with the company, we were about $12 million in revenue and about 140 people. And we've gone through a lot of changes over time. We were one company back in the 90s, and then we went to the business unit model to help with growth, to help get into different areas of servicing our clients. And then through that, we just, in around 2000, we were probably around $40 million. And then in 2014, we were about $100 million. And this past year, we'll be right around $500 million. So our growth has been steady by spurts. Anywhere from a seven-year run, we probably have 4 to 5 really good growth years. And then we plateau a couple of years, and then we start again. So it's a little bit of the S-curve model. And some of that's, you know, by happenstance, and some of that's by choice, and some of that's by economic situations that we had to go through and benefit from and endure at times too. But all in all, one of the things that started from there is the foundation of our core values and wanting to be servant leaders and, you know, trying to create an environment that our people could really thrive and make a difference. And 1996, we kind of had our core values launched. In 2005, we added a vision statement. And then 2012, we added the why statements from Simon Sinek's why. And that was probably the pivotal change in our culture. Prior to that, I would say our culture was probably owned by the leaders. You know, we talked about the values, we talked about the vision, we talked about the direction. And once we launched the why statements, it was really amazing, because that's when our team members started talking about our culture more than we did as leaders. And I kind of say that's when the culture was owned by the team members, the employees. And that's awesome. They're the ones that talk about it. They're the ones that really love it. They're the ones that promote it and institutionalize it. And that's been a huge benefit, one that we kind of always strive for, but you know, in reality, you didn't know if it was going to happen or not, and it did, and very fortunate from that side of it.
That's super helpful. I'm curious, what were the key moments or decisions that really shaped this transformation as you go from like 12 million to 40 to 100 to then 500?
One of the things we realized early on is there's so much you don't know. And you might know your situation exceptionally well. You might know your clients exceptionally well, your company and all that. But when you're changing, when you're growing, there's different levels of organization. And it's that old saying, you know, what got you here won't get you to where you want to go. And you have to change some of the things that you really hold dearly and might be really good at. But you have to create space for the new. And Our founder was John A. Franken. He passed along to his son in 1995 in August. And then Jim had a little a different vision than his dad. His dad was very traditional, top down. Jim wanted to change the culture a little bit more on the servant leadership side of it and create more opportunities for people to lead. And when we're, I remember talking, there was probably, I don't know, 10 of us in the room, and we talked about the biggest challenge we had was having enough leaders. Leaders were really probably the biggest constraint that we had to reach our potential. And from then on, we always tried to do different things to do leadership development and make sure people understood their self-awareness from their strengths, their weaknesses, where they need to work on from that side of it. So when you're going from top down to more of a team environment, you have to give up some things that people hold very dearly, which one is control. I mean, you know, when you're a small company and it's top down, it's easy. You make all the big decisions and you have to live with it, and you're usually good with that. To give space to have other leaders make decisions, and some you agree with, some you kind of agree with, some you say, "Oh, I'm not sure about that," but we're going to trust the process, trust the leader, and go forward from that. That was probably one of the bigger things that we had to learn how to do. And at times, we're still learning how to do that too, because situations change, people change, interstates changes. And one of the other pivotal things during in the 2000s is Jim actually passed away when he was 48 years old. And in 2001, we had a retirement of a long-term leader, a shareholder. Then we had Jim Franken pass away, and then went into the dot-com bust. And then we had one of our contracts, our largest contract at the time, taken away because of the M&A. The new owner just canceled the contract, and we lost some backlog from that. So at that time, I think everybody has a story like that where you have to show a little bit of grit and resilience and figure it out. And we had a great team back then. And, you know, every challenge is an opportunity. And so what was this opportunity? It gave us an opportunity to redefine ourselves and really go forward in a different model, because Jim wasn't around anymore. So we had to lead differently and create opportunities for other people to lead and different opportunities to go after from that side of it. It still was traumatic, and I wouldn't wish that on anybody from that side of it. And I think some of those lessons learned and scars are still with me today. Some of them good, some of them bad. But then, you know, as the business unit model grew, we actually ended up getting some feedback. It probably started in 2010, but definitely got it in between 14, 15, and 16, that a lot of our clients saying told us we were getting hard to work with. We weren't acting like one company. We started acting like three different companies. So we had to take a step back and reflect and kind of redefine ourselves again and say, what did we want to do? So we kind of rolled that model till it made sense. And then we switched models to more of an agile or a Helix model, in order to give us more flexibility and agility to wrap our arms around opportunities, wrap our arms around clients. The one thing, as you get bigger, the one thing that was really hard, and we still struggle with it, is redeploying resources. A lot of times when you deploy resources, it feels like it's forever. You know, they can't transfer out. So it doesn't create as much opportunities for the individual, doesn't create as much opportunities for the various leaders or the business units. And you actually end up at times almost competing against yourselves for talent, and that's not good. So when we started getting all that feedback, that's when we wanted to do the kind of like another S curve and redesign ourselves, reimagine ourselves, and kind of do this new structure that kind of put us in a better spot as at a larger company. And I'm sure at some point this is going to have its full life cycle, and you're going to have to reimagine it again.
One thing you said, Scott, that I want to talk about and love to hear your perspective on is you all identified the single biggest constraint being leaders, the number of leaders that you had that could row with you. I mean, we certainly see that as well. You've got the president of 1,000 helpers. You know, that business will only scale but so far, just by definition. And that requires a mindset shift of the existing leaders to give up control, which is the word you used, right? So at some point, there has to be sort of a giving up of control and then a feeling of being okay with, okay, some decisions will get made, some mistakes will be made, but on balance, if we develop the leaders, then we'll trust in those leaders to make net much better decisions. We'll be a much better place. I'm curious, what did you all do to crack the code on shifting the mindset of the existing leadership team to be okay with giving up that level of control?
Yeah, well, I can't say that we cracked the code. I think we made progress. I think it's a journey. And to be honest, I'd probably say you have to give up the illusion of control. Technically, you never have control. You just have this illusion of control.
Good
And
point.
so part of that is just being honest. It's like you never really had control. You maybe had some influence. And there was a book back in the 90s, and it was the I think it was called The Greatest Leadership Principle. It was about servant leadership. And it said, your best day as a leader is when you use influence. Your worst day as a leader is when you use power. And power is equivalent to control. It's about a lot towards fear. So probably in the last several years, one of the things we've started talking about, I'll go back to the very beginning too, but recently, we've been framing it as, do you want to lead out of love or do you want to lead out of fear? If you lead out of fear, you're really going to be talking about controlling. You're going to be, trying to get specific things. And it's very, that's where that micromanaging stereotype gets into it because you're in their gears and then you're not giving them any space. If you're leading out of love, you're wanting to do the best for others, best for the client, best for the team, best for that individual team member or leader. What's best for them? Where can they flourish? Where can they have the biggest impact? And you learn to kind of do the balance of you got to be in the know so you can be helpful and it'd be a good resource and provide boundaries. And you also have to give space for them to make decisions, which some are going to be good and some are not going to be good. And really trying to keep that at the forefront of your mind. Because under stress, people are going to regress. And when you're under stress, that means when you're regressing, that means you're going back to the controlling or fear-based leadership. And you have to be very cognizant of that.
Well, Scott, I couldn't agree more. You shared a few things, just the whole love versus fear, and I look at that as like the mindset, growth versus scarcity, right? And you can look at a company, spend time with them, and understand very quickly kind of where they fall on that scale, growth versus scarcity. I'd love for you to just talk a little bit about, given the various S curves that you all have experienced and led through, if you had to narrow it down, what would you say you're most proud of?
I kind of hate those kind of questions, but I'll answer it anyway. So, a couple things that I'm most proud of. Back during the Great Recession, back in the mid-2000, the construction industry was hit really, really hard. A lot of companies were down and markets were down 40 to 60%. We were very fortunate to have some diversity within our markets and a great relationship with our clients. And during that time period, we were at around 83 million, and we were 83 million for about 3 years in a row. And it sounds odd, but it's not about growth, but that defined resilience for me, for us to face that kind of adversity and to do that and to continue to develop our people, continue to work on our culture, to continue to add services for our clients and continue to build relationships, do work how run business how we want to run business and not have to contract like a lot of other companies did. That was probably one of the things that I think speaks highly for the leadership team that we have and all our team members at Interstates during that time period. I'm going to change your question. So here's a couple other ones that I was proud of. I think when Jim passed away, there was that was traumatic. And a lot of people, a lot of companies didn't think we were going to make it. And I think that's where that fortitude and resilience and for me, it's almost what is our mission? And out of that kind of challenge, the opportunity was to almost reimagine ourselves as we want to be an enduring company. We want to be in a company that lasts past multiple generations. So we can pass our culture along to the next generation. So they can have the similar opportunities that we had being part of interstates. They're not fun times by any means. But when you look back, you end up accomplishing a lot during adversity. And I think some people say adversity builds character. Other people's adversity reveals character. I'm not sure which one I probably, it probably changes on the day, which way I probably would look at it. But when you're working with good people and you have great leaders and you're focused on what we want to accomplish long term, then almost anything's possible. And I think those were two really good stories of it. And even just recently with COVID, I mean, everybody, COVID's a four-letter word basically, and nobody wants to talk about it. And it wasn't fun. It was scary. I mean, that was as scary as some of the stuff I did. I'd never seen shutdowns before. I mean, we were all over the country and we didn't know what was going on. And it was pretty impressive to see our current leadership team kind of rally around it. We created a nerve center so we could be faster and have more empowerment to our sub teams that could research and do different things, talk about safety, talk about clients. So it wouldn't get bogged down in decision making at the top. We created this nerve center that really rose to the occasion and really created confidence we could get through it from that side of it. So those are probably three of the bigger ones that really pop out to me that when I look back, those are some amazing things leadership teams really did here at Interstates.
You talk about being really pushed and adversity revealing character. I think, we have a colleague that's fond of saying all development happens at the edge, at the edge of your comfort zone and maybe slightly past. If it's always comfortable, if it's always stasis, nothing ever changes. You kind of stay stuck. But something you just shared there, Scott, about the nerve center that you created out of necessity during COVID, just to get speed to decision, speed to execution. What from those days stuck and have kind of changed the way that you operate the business today as a leadership team?
So in 2018, we started researching what we need to do different, moving away from the business unit model and figuring out what we want to do next. We made research and did some decisions. We launched it in October 19, and we were just going through that right before COVID hit. So the COVID hit, and some of the things that learned back in the Great Recession and even the dot-com bust in the early 2000s, and even in the 90s, there were some tough economic times we had to deal with there. So bringing those lessons learned, saying we had this is opportunity to share that knowledge with younger leaders and give them direction and empower them to make certain decisions. So one of the things that the world was changing so fast, and everybody wanted decisions fast and all that, and we kind of said historically what we go into when we go into a crisis, and it gets pretty boring, but calm and confident. That's what we're going to do. We're not going to be rash. We're not going to be jumping to conclusions. We're not going to be acting on assumptions. We're going to be calm and confident. So this nerve center said, what sub teams do we need? All right, we have to understand what's changing in the law, what's really happening in the laws, what are we really required to? Can we rent cars? Can we do this? Can we do that? Can we go into the state? So this small sub team said, you're in charge of researching that and telling us what we can do. Don't give me five different things we may or may not do. That doesn't help. Tell me what I can and can't do. I want clear lines. And then we talked about how to support our team members, how to do remote work, how do we could do all those type of things. We had safety, we had traditional safety, and then the safety related to COVID. We had a communications team, we had a financial team, we had a client team, all those type of things. We created small teams. Now, what we do is when we have an issue, we actually say, can a small team move faster than us? Let's do a sprint. This sprint might last a week, it might last 2 months, but you're in charge of this is stolen from extreme ownership from Echelon Front, but what's the mission? What's the what? What's the why? What's the deliverable? And when is it due? If you give that to a team, they can come back and we can ask clarifying questions, but this is what you have. in 2 months, in 2 weeks, you have to deliver this. Yes or no, what's your pivot among that? Or if we have something wrong, we can always pivot from that. So that's probably empowered us to do that more. And at times we do exceptionally well at that. At other times we kind of struggle at it because we didn't define the what or the why good enough from that side of it. You go in vague and you're going to end up with a vague deliverable at the end, which isn't very helpful. So for us, it really expedited that the new org structure. It expedited us doing these sprints. It expedited us doing this mission clarity, all those type of things. It really just expedited all those things. And knowing that I don't, I mean, there's most decisions I should not make. The decisions need to belong to whoever is the most appropriate. Sometimes that's the closest. Sometimes that's someone that's objectives. That sometimes it's a team saying, you bring ex you're an expert in the client, you're the expert in the technology, you're the expert in this situation. Here's an objective leader coming in, just making sure we're not just going down a rabbit hole from that side of it. So giving clarity on what we're doing, also making sure we're forming a team fairly balanced that can complement each other, and then telling them when it's due, they have to deliver. A lot of times when you go to committees or teams, it can last forever, and that's a bad thing. People do better with the finish line. What is the finish line? It's hard for leaders to define the finish line, but if you do that well, the teams usually perform exceptionally well.
I was listening to an interview with one of the leaders from Y Combinator this morning, who's Silicon Valley venture VC fund and startup accelerator. And it's a little bit of a parallel, but he was talking about they'll interview potential startup teams for 10 minutes on Zoom to figure out which ones are they going to put through their program and back. And it's intentionally 10 minutes, because if the team can't articulate the what and the why it matters in 10 minutes, then there is no what, and it really doesn't matter. So that clarity, they bet right way more than 99.9% of all the others out there. But they're not 100%. But to your point about clarity on the front end, what are you solving for? What does success look like? What are the constraints? Going back to the Simon Sinek, right? You've got the Wright brothers example, I think he used, which had no money, no fancy degrees, versus all these really well-heeled, well-funded groups who were trying to accomplish flight and who got there first. So, Scott, if you had to bottle up what makes Interstates unique, what would be in the recipe?
Hard question to boil it down to. I'll try, and hopefully the people back in Interstates won't laugh at me too bad. But for me, it starts with our culture. So we have three elements of our culture. It's our core values. It's building relationships through dependability, integrity, trust, quality, and family. The Interstates family is a huge part of it. Then our vision is understanding needs, delivering results. And our why statements are soon a better way, making a difference with our clients and our communities, and providing opportunities for our people. That is the foundation to our secret sauce. From that, how we live that out is really making a difference. That covers all of Interstates. So for us, we want to make sure that we're providing opportunities for our people so they can serve our clients better. We want to make sure that we're pursuing a better way so we can make a bigger impact on our clients and potentially for our communities. And when it comes together, when we can bundle all those things together, that's when we're the most unique. And one of the things that really makes for me a huge validation of that is when you're onboarding people, everybody. When you're recruiting, when you're sourcing, all that kind of stuff, everybody else says the same stuff. Hey, it's our people, it's our culture, and all that. And I'm kind of saying the same thing. When I can come to someone that has been with the company 3 months, 9 months, and they say, you kind of really undersold the culture. It is really what you talk about, you actually do more of than most companies. For me, when I can get feedback from a field person, from someone that's been with the company for 6 months and say, this is what's going good, this is what's not going good, this is where we're passionate, this is where an opportunity is, this is where we're messing up. That's the secret sauce, is when it's all working together as a system is what makes us unique from that side of it. And that's pretty amazing stuff when it all comes together from that side of it.
So from there, I would love to shift and talk about the future. So as you think about fast forward to 2035, 10 years out, we've talked a lot about the transformations that brought you to this point. So how would you articulate the vision for interstates in 2035?
So right now we're actually building Interstates 2030. So you're going to push me a little bit more, which is good. For me, one of the things that we need to do is navigate our for ourselves and also help our clients navigate the disruptions that are going to happen to the United States business and some society. So the big disruptors are going to be leveraging data. It's going to be AI. It's going to be how can we get more work done on the construction side with less workers? How can we attract at least even more workers than are going into trades right now? How can we attract more? Because we will need more. So there's so many disruptions that we can see. And most likely the biggest disruptions are the ones we can't see yet. And how can we be prepared for that? So you can't predict the future. You shouldn't try to predict the future. But what you can do is create a base foundation to make sure that you can adapt to it, so you can help others adapt through it and navigate through it. For me, for Interstates, is that I think we're going to continue to grow. Right now we're at 500 million, and we're looking at 2030 and 2035. We're going to be well north of $1 billion. And for the most part, I've always said is I know we're going to be a $1 billion company. I know we're going to be a $2 billion company. I don't know when. And in actuality, I don't know if I care that much. The key is that we're a healthy organization. We have to continue to grow. We have to continue to get better. We have to continue to add services. We have to occasionally stop doing things that don't add as much value, or we can't do it to the level that our clients do, that we have to bring a partner in to do it. We have to continue to push ourselves and be real with ourselves on what we are excelling at, what we're struggling with, and what the client and what the marketplace needs from us. But for me, I think construction is always going to be a big part of us. We've always been in the industrial market sector, and that's going to continue to do so. Whether it's processing plants or manufacturing or data centers, that's going to be the heart and soul of where we're always functioning. We're also adding on the technology side, whether it's engineering or programming or analytics or instrumentation or a lot of different other things that are going to be coming down the road, is that we have to put those together. Historically, they can be separated, but there is a convergence of things happening right now. And I think for us, data analytics, AI is going to impact the construction industry significantly. I'm not sure how yet, but for us, we have to make sure we're providing those services for our clients from an operation side, their operation side of it. But from their CapEx side of it, there's going to be opportunities for us to do it better. And that's one of the reasons why we're investing fairly heavily into prefab, into manufacturing, into products, because we have to make ourselves more productive. All these other industries are being more productive. Construction is not keeping pace. We are significantly behind if you compare us to other industries. So we have to get at times kind of radical on how we can do that. We have to be way more productive, to be competitive, to help our clients be more competitive, because we could be an asset to our clients by being more productive, ensuring we have high productivity, quality, and safety, or we could be a liability if we're not keeping up, if we're not helping them do that. And that's one of the things that we talk a lot about it as an industry, but we haven't delivered like we need to for our clients.
To your point about disruption coming to the construction industry, we certainly would agree with that. I think if you think about construction projects, simply speaking, from an owner's perspective, are a means to an end. It's to provide a service, provide a financial return, or facilitate production, if you kind of boil it down into, and I'm quoting Jay Bowman, whom you know. But there's three buckets, and you could put 90 plus percent of all construction projects into probably one of those three buckets. And so, to the extent that friction can be taken out of that process to get an owner to their ends sooner, people are going to invest in that and figure it out. It's just a question of when. Scott, you mentioned something that I think it came from the book you recommended, CEO Excellence, about you talked about saying goodbye to things or services or products that no longer make sense or that could be done better by somebody else. But that whole mindset of kill as much as you create, that says easy, does hard. There's a lot of firms and a lot of leaders that really struggle with giving up anything that has worked for them in the past. So maybe if you could talk for a second about kind of how you all have adopted that mindset to be able to part with those things that no longer, based on the data or intuition, don't make sense anymore.
Yeah, I'd probably say we're average right now. And I want us to be way above average. I want us to be exceptional in the next 3 years. One of the things that we're exploring, and this goes back to thinking about strategy, thinking about the future. There's some information out there about you can have first generation thinking, second generation, third generation. First generation, they don't have much. They bet it all. They're very innovative. They're very bold. They're taking chances. Second generation have seen how hard that is, and they end up protecting that. They don't want to take chances. Third generation, they said, this is the way it's always been. They're almost entitled that it's not that big a struggle from that side of it. And that's when you can get happy, fat, and lazy from that side of it. So one of the things we're starting to integrate, and we've started this just probably in the last year when we've been working more on with the executive team, is thinking about it from which generation are we going to be in. We have to be purposeful at times. We have to think like first generation. So what are we going to boldly create? What are we going to boldly destroy in order to create something new from that side of it? So from that mentality, we're going to be experimenting on that. Our first one, which we didn't actually use that methodology when we actually made the decision, but one of our strategic themes is in the industrial model. We have to industrialize the construction process in order to be more productive, to have higher quality, to have higher safety, to help our clients as much as we can. That means we have to standardize products. We have to do design decisions earlier so we can leverage mods. We have to do all these things earlier, and we have to change how we're actually doing our work. How many of our people and even the whole industry is basically doing the same thing we did back in the 2000s and the 90s and maybe even in the 80s? We've just made it look pretty with more technology and all that, but we haven't substantially changed how we do our work. We have to change how we do our work moving forward. That's the only, we have to let go of those standards. We have to let go of those things that gave us a lot of kudos for how smart we are, how creative we are, all those types. We have to let go of that and do something we've never done before, which is scary. And that's where the resistance comes into play. So for killing stuff, what we want to do is more, you don't kill for kill's sake. And I think that's where a lot of the old mentality comes from. It's really, you're trying to recreate, reimagine, and you just happen to have to kill something in order to get there. That's probably the more appropriate way to look at it. Otherwise, you end up just doing some hodgepodge that doesn't necessarily help the system a whole lot or the processes in order to create value for your clients. Whether it's true or not, I kind of looked at it when we went from the one company to the business units. We killed being the one company. When we went from the three business units back to one company, we killed the three business units. That's kind of, we had to let go. There's a lot of attachment and a lot of pushback saying, we're successful. I mean, we did this at a peak of how successful we were in growing and profitability and all that, and you're changing everything. Are you trying to destroy interstates? Those are some of the things that I heard when we were going through that. And that's, when you're hearing that, you can't listen to it. You take it as it's a signal that they're maybe nervous, they're scared, they don't understand. So you just have to lean into a little bit more. Don't take what they're saying verbatim of what they're really saying. You got to take it more of a signal. Otherwise, you're just going to be chasing your tail all over the place. I think that's one thing that's going to be, I think every company could really benefit is we have to do things differently in order to get different results.
Years ago, I read something in a change management book around change. And the quote was something to the effect of everyone loves progress, but everyone hates change. but nothing progresses by staying the same. The difference is purpose, which you've kind of talked about as a through line through a lot of this discussion, is the purpose and the why, and your reinventing of the company is out of necessity to thrive in the future, but there's a clear purpose on why you're doing it that underpins all of it. Scott, in one of our previous conversations, you used a baseball analogy to describe the different types of clients that Interstate has. Be great to unpack a little bit about what that means and how you all use that analogy internally.
So when we were probably around 80 million, we were pretty much treating all of our clients the same. And there's this the you heard the golden rule, treat others like you want to be treated. And then there's the platinum rule, treat people how they want to be treated. So when we started looking at it, is that we have different relationships with different clients. We should treat them differently from that side of it. So what we did is we did a number of research and we came up with the baseball analogy. We have all-star clients, we have veterans, we have rookies, and we have transactional clients. And a lot of that is what kind of relationship do they want with us? Would we want all of our clients to be all-stars? Yeah, that would be kind of nice, but that'd probably be not very long-term healthy for them or for us. For us, what we want to do is the all-stars, we want to give them as much as they want in help. We can help with looking into the future, making sure we have enough capacity. We can give them advice on different things that they're looking at. We can help them on technology. We can give them, we walk beside them a lot more and making sure that when it comes to a project, and one of the biggest constraints on the construction side is electricians, we make sure that we take care of our all-stars. They're in the go, no-go meetings, they get priority. We are committed to them. So we try to wrap our arms around the all-stars, making sure we're investing in the right way, the amount that they want. Now, the veterans, we have great relationships. We've had long terms, decade long, and those are extremely valuable. However, we don't want to overinvest with them. We could start bothering them if we're bugging them too much. So sometimes it's just the volume they're doing. Sometimes it's their general approach, but we have a great relationship. We stay in contact, but not as often. If they want to additional services, we can do that. We don't assume that. So we're very purposeful from that. Rookies are the ones that are new. Everybody likes getting the new client. The first job with a new client is hard. You don't know how they operate. They don't know how we operate. So there's sometimes a lot of miscommunication. There's some struggles on the project or whatever, or maybe some frustration. So when we classify someone as a rookie, we want to make sure we're committed to making sure we do several projects with them. So we're looking at how can we pursue a better way with this client? How can we make a better experience for them? How can we add more value to them? We want to grow that relationship, but we don't know where it's going to grow yet. So we're very purposeful about onboarding an employee, onboarding a client, just to make sure that we're giving them the best experience and the best value that they can, that they we can at that time. And then the transactional, some clients are just transactional. They don't want a relationship. That's not how they're designed. But when times are tough or when a transactional client comes to us and it fits our backlog, then we'll do it. If it doesn't, then we won't. And we don't feel bad about it. I think a lot of times we used to feel bad about saying no to anybody. And it's like, no, that's kind of their deal. If it fits, great. If it doesn't, don't overextend ourselves. That's not what they want. They want us to be able to deliver, not just to say yes on day one. So for us, it gives us a lot more clarity of how to deploy, how to invest in our clients properly and in a way that is mutually beneficial. One quick story is we had a rookie client and with bigger projects, and I was talking to them and I was explaining this to them. And they asked, and they said, "So are we an all-star client?" And I looked at there's like three other people in the room, and I'm going, "This is going to get interesting." I said, "No, you're not. You're a rookie. We don't know each other good enough to be an all-star." And I didn't know how that was going to flow. I didn't know if they were going to get mad or and they said, "Well, that's good. I think that's being realistic. And we don't know each other. This is a journey, so we have to go good." So it went over exceptionally well. I think it's just being real and being honest with people. And if we got a great relationship, awesome. If we have a start of a great relationship, that's awesome too, but it's different.
Well, I think in general, authenticity as a default is a good thing, right?
Yep.
Scott, I'd love to shift into strategy a little bit and just kind of where and how you think about placing your bets as an organization. Would love to understand a little bit more about how you identify the right market sectors where interstates can be most successful.
So for us, one of the things we want to understand is you have to understand the market. Is there opportunity in the market? Is it declining? Is it status quo? And is it growth? And there is great opportunity even in a slow growth or a flat market. It just looks different from that side of it. So first you look at the pool and then you look at the clients with that. Do we have relationships? Do we have opportunities to grow that? Are they growing? Are they doing things differently? Do they fit us? I mean, if someone's very traditional and risk adverse, we might not be the best fit for them. Because we want to try different things. We want to try to help them do things a little bit differently, a little bit better in the future, not just crank out the same thing every time. Meeting their standards is really important, but we also have to know that pursuing a better way is how can we level up a little bit every time, or maybe even once in a while, a big leap if they want to do that. But for me, the bottom line is, can we stand out? And that's when we just don't want to be one of five. The old saying is, you got to do different things or you got to do things differently. And for us, we want to be different by providing engineering, providing automation, providing analytics, providing a wide range of services. We can go into places that are very rural and bring in a lot of people in to get things done. Not very many companies can do that. We have a unique perspective is most electrical companies start out local, regional, and then they try to do national. We were completely backwards. We got in the industrial back in the late 60s, and we were national to begin with, and we didn't have a local presence till the 1990s. We occasionally would do jobs around the area, but the old joke is the closer it is closer to home, the more management's going to get and the worse the project will do. So we did better when it was a little bit farther away. So we were coast to coast when we were a very small company. So we grew up with this mindset of we can go anywhere if it makes sense. Licensing is a big deal, but we can mobilize. So we can do big projects in out of the way places. We can do processing, we can do manufacturing, we can do data centers. So the niche of what we do in the industrial manufacturing space is crucial. We try to avoid, and we've gone in a couple times over our history into commercial, and it's okay in good times, but as soon as that gets a little bit tight, then we just get crushed because we're not geared to that. We don't think that way. We can't perform at some of the same levels as other companies in that niche. So giving up the commercial market, it was a big deal, is that we're mainly in that niche of manufacturing industrial. So look at the clients, look at the markets. Those give you an indication of kind of where to go. Then bring in our offering and do we have a chance of standing out and competing in that? And if we do, then it's about, okay, we got to have that resume. We got to show them how to do it, that we can do it and we can handle it. And then we focus on building trust by being real and being authentic with them.
How do you think about the tension between diversification and specialization?
We're having those conversations just right now. So for me, it's a pendulum. And I think you have to go back and forth. I think you go from diversification back to fortification, back to diversification to fortification. And it's just a natural thing that you have to go back and forth from that side of it. Once you get into a couple more markets, then you have to come back and really fortify your position in those markets, strengthen that, add some more clients to that, or add some more scope to that, or make sure that you can have influence or is well known in a market. For us, what we do is we try to say, here are our top markets. Our top markets are the ones that, lack of a better way to say it, we do over $100 million worth of work in a 3-year period. That's a top market for us. We are known, we'll invest in that market, we'll go to the association trade shows. We want to be known as one of the experts in there, and we want to invest in that market and then invest in the clients. For us, you can't have 100 top markets because then you're just hopping around. So when we're in a top market, we want to stay in that top market for a long, long time until that market is decreasing or something substantially changes. But that's our commitment to it. So that's where we want to make sure our people know that we're committed to those. And now then we have next markets and ones were emerging markets, and then we're investing a little bit like our All-Star analogy is we want to make sure we're investing and researching in those. And it's easy to hop on the train that everybody's on. We've done that over the years. There was the ethanol boom, the biodiesel boom, you had the oil and gas boom, you have the data center boom, and everybody says, let's be all in. And I said, no, I don't want, I never want to be all in, mainly because I want to have enough balance that if that there's a crash, we're not at risk of going away from that side of it. So we look at it from a market diversity, make sure our portfolio is well balanced. It's like a 401k portfolio. You don't want to be all in foreign markets. It may look good for 2 years, but then you're going to be left holding the bag long term. And when something's really a market that's really, really hot, look at it as a gold rush. Gold rushes start out fast, but a lot of times they don't end very well. And who usually does best at them is the people that are supporting them. So part of it is we'll participate in all the ones, but we're not going to go overboard in any of them.
Again, says easy, does hard. So
Oh yeah,
it's a
yeah.
discipline and a really important discipline. If you want to be an enduring company, back to what you shared earlier, right? The way to do that is to not get over your skis anywhere where you risk the existential crisis. Well, Scott, this has been a great conversation. I can't thank you enough for your time. One final question, if you're okay with it. I would love for you to kind of go back to your first day as CEO, and if you could whisper to yourself one piece of advice, knowing what you know now, what would that be?
I use this analogy a lot, especially when you're talking about situational leadership. When do you feel the best? When you're an eighth grader, you're the king of the mountain. When you're a senior in high school, senior in college, you know it all. You've been there, all that kind of stuff. Then what does day one, next day happens? Freshman in high school, freshman in college, first job. You don't know where the bathrooms are at. And you go from knowing everything to knowing nothing. So this isn't just one thing. This is probably a couple of ones. And I try to do this, even though I might fail at times, is you got to be humble because otherwise you're going to get humbled and you'll still get humbled, but not as often. The second one is I just heard this recently is when you're taking the job as CEO, the one thing you got to remember is you can't outwork the job. There is always going to be something to do. You have to find your pace. So make sure that the other jobs you could do outwork your job, but CEO, you can never outwork your job. The most important advice I would say is if I would tell myself back in 2014, I would say, look at it as chapters of a book. And for me, if you look at it, I got, an 18-year run as a CEO. That's too long to look at. I mean, you're going to go too slow. You might get distracted and all that kind of stuff. So for me, one of the things I encourage someone to do is say, what's your 5 year? Your first year is go out and do a listening tour. Listen, ask as many questions of your people, of your clients, of your partners, of your vendors. Get a good feel for it. Don't make any big decisions, mainly because you're making it from your old position, not from your new position. So you got to get the objective, you got to get distance, you got to get perspective in that first year. Second year, the second chapter is maybe where do you want to take the company in 3 to 5, 5 years? Get that longer term out there. And then the next couple chapters, you're just building towards that. When you're getting close to that 5 year or 7 year vision of what you had, stop and redo the whole thing all over again. Do a listening tour, get perspective, get objectivity, get insight, get advice, learn as much as you can, relearn about the company as much as you can, and then do that 5 year and then build towards that. So one of it is just having that methodology, I think would have helped me back then. And that's I'm implementing it right now is I've been 10, 11 years now as CEO, and then I have probably another 5, 6 years left. And I'm looking at it from that side of it is how can I do that? And actually seeing past me to make sure that I can position the next CEO as well as they can be, and making sure that the transition can be as easy as possible. As I'm walking out the door, there may be saying thanks, but they'll be saying the best is yet to come because we've got a strong team. We got a strong leader. We have strong vision. We have a great culture, all those type of things. So a lot of things I'm doing right now is trying to position the company to excel after me. And I think that's when you have that kind of mission, and it's not just me. I think a lot of our leaders that are around my age at Interstates are thinking the same thing. How can I position this role or Interstates to be better once I'm there? Because the job of a leader is really to position the next person to really do an exceptional job and better than what you did.
Wow, those are great answers and very thoughtful answers, Scott. I really appreciate one, you thinking through how you would respond to that question. But also, I can't thank you enough for your time. This great conversation. You have the privilege of leading a remarkable organization, and we appreciate you spending time with us today.
You bet. I definitely enjoyed it and wish you guys the best of luck too, and hopefully best is yet to come.
Thanks, Scott. Thank you for listening to another episode of Built In, and please remember to like or subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode.